Blog Talk Radio.
On tonight's show, legendary film producer Mark Damon discusses his fascinating life in motion pictures with his biographer Linda Schreier. Pete Geldenblom will talk about Directorama, his new book of cinema-themed comic strips, and filmmakers Morgan Neville and Robert Gordon stop by to discuss their new A&E documentary on the unifying appeal of Johnny Cash. It's all coming up next on Movie Geeks United. Welcome to Movie Geeks United. We got a great show for you tonight. My name is Jamie.
My name is Jerry.
There you go. Perfect, perfect.
Yeah, I mean.
Yeah, we really pulled that introduction off. Great. We have a wonderful show for you tonight, and we're very excited about tonight's show. Just a couple of notes before we get started. We do have a chat room. If you're a movie fan, you got to go into the chat room. It's great movie talk. Go in there. You'll have a great time. Just click the chat available icon on the homepage there. On our homepage, you'll also see icons of several products, including the book about Mr. Damon's life that we'll be discussing tonight, and the Johnny Cash's America film that we're discussing later on in the show as well. You click on either of those icons, it'll take you directly to the Amazon.com page from which those are sold. So you can we're one-stop shopping. We take care of everything.
We do.
That's what we are. And if you're a movie fan, stick by us for the next couple of weeks. We have some great shows upcoming, including a tribute to the Costa Gavras film Missing. That'll be next Sunday. We'll be talking to several members of the cast and crew of that film. And we just confirmed actors Robert Davi and Chaz Palminteri for November 9th. So good stuff coming up.
Yeah, sounds good.
Yeah, yeah. So Jerry will be manning the chat room. If you have any questions, please submit them through there. We have a wonderful show, and I'm so excited about these first guests. I read this book yesterday, and it's just an amazing tale. We seem to have a lot of lines on the switchboard that are lighting up. Our first guests are Mr. Damon and Ms. Schreier, so I'm not for certain what the exact area codes of those guests are, so this might be might be a little experimental here, but let's get started. We are joined tonight by a true cinematic legend, Mr. Mark Damon. He's been called the godfather of independent film and the pioneer of international film financing and the foreign motion picture sales market. As a young actor, he studied under Meisner, befriended talents like Natalie Wood, Robert Towne, and Jack Nicholson, and even won a Golden Globe Award for Most Promising Newcomer in 1961. Through his company, Producer Sales Organization, he played a major role in shaping the voice of American independent film, and most profoundly, in how those films are received throughout the world. His roster of astounding producing credits from this period include Das Boot, The Neverending Story, 9½ Weeks, Short Circuit, Flight of the Navigator, and The Lost Boys. And in recent years, he's produced or executive produced many more terrific films, like The Upside of Anger and the Oscar-winning Monster. And that doesn't even scratch the surface of the many classic and at times infamous projects for which he's played an indelible role in bringing to the screen, from The Cotton Club to Once Upon a Time in America. In The Cowboy, the Mogul, and the Monster, the never-ending story of Mark Damon, author Linda Schreier chronicles this remarkable life with stunning clarity, candor, and compassion. Painstakingly developed over the course of 5 years, her book conveys the scope of this grand and multifaceted life in a gorgeously constructed narrative that's sure to delight and inspire even the most casual of film fans. It is a tremendous pleasure to welcome Mr. Mark Damon and Ms. Linda Schreier to Movie Geeks United. Mr. Damon, are you with us?
I'm with you.
Mr. David, hello. Thanks so much. Let me see if I can bring
thank
up.
You. The book sounds great. I'd love to buy one.
Ms. Schreier, are you with us?
I am. Hello.
Hi. Thank you so
Hi.
Much, so much, both of you, for joining us tonight.
I just have one question, Jamie. You got the book yesterday and you read the whole thing in one day? You are incredible.
I could not put it down. I mean, first of all, literally I could not put it down because I had to finish it yesterday. But it is a fantastic book about such an extraordinary life. That is still so vital today as it ever has been, and I can't wait to delve into this this amazing life with you. But first of all, let me ask how this book got started. And I'll start with you, Linda. I know you're a very successful screenwriter and writer of some very popular episodic television. You've even written a stage musical, and I want to ask you about that a little later. But tell me how you came to meet Mr. Damon and how this book got started for you.
Well, I actually met Mark through his wife, Maggie. And Maggie and I were close friends for a number of years. And one morning, about a little more than 5 years ago, we were having coffee. And I had been teaching memoir writing for a number of years. And I said I was ready to write someone else's story instead of just teaching other people how to write their own. And Maggie said, well, then you have to write Mark's. And so that's how it came about.
Wow.
Not quite. And you had to meet me first. You had to meet me first, and you had to talk to me about it. And I was very busy, and I really didn't have time to do anything like this. And I said, "Well, how long will this take?" And Linda said, 6 months. I'm fast." So 5 years later, we finally got it published.
Yeah, and it was quite a feat here in a period of 5 years. And I would think that over that time, the relationship between a biographer and her subject would have to develop into something pretty pretty intimate, because you're sharing...
I can't talk about that. My
Well, I'm wondering, Mr. David, was this a difficult experience in some ways, and was it ultimately cathartic for you?
I think cathartic is really a good word, because as I recounted my life to Linda, and she began to point out to me why I did what I did and at what point, by pointing out that this might have happened when your mother told you this at the age of 7, and that's why you did this when you were 32. And so it was more than catharsis. It was like a total psychoanalysis. It was an extraordinary experience. But I had to have someone extraordinary to point it out to me, which was Linda.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. And the book is written... It's so unique and almost cinematic in a way. It's written in a kind of nonlinear style, and I'm wondering what the thinking behind that structure was, Linda.
You know, it's so interesting. I started out writing it chronologically, and Mark was the first one to point out to me that people were not going to want to read about his taking a bus out to Los Angeles at the age of 13 on page 60. And I realized he was right. And so then I thought, well, what if I cut back and forth as a film would, and having written films and studied films, I thought, why don't I just do this? And I never thought that anyone would be able to follow it. I thought people were going to hate that, and it was the worst thing I had done. And Mark continuously reassured me that it was going to be fine, just fine. So it's really great to hear that you enjoy that part of it, because it kept me always interested.
Mm-hmm.
And as you said, you know, this is a life that's so grand and has so many different aspects to it that I just wanted to make sure to tell it in hopefully somewhat as interesting a manner in which it's been lived.
Oh, yeah.
And just to stay true to that.
Yeah, what an amazing life. And I want to discuss your life. You know, we don't have a 4 or 5 hour show tonight, so we'll have to cram this in as quickly as possible. But I know, Mr. Damon, that you started out as an actor, and eventually, in your young career, you studied under Sanford Meisner. And
mm-hmm.
I'm wondering what that experience did for you, what you got from Mr. Meisner.
Well, it was devastating initially, because I came to New York and studied at the Neighborhood Playhouse after I'd been acting in Hollywood for about 4 or 5 years. And one day, a friend of mine who was a member of the Actors Studio told me that I would never make it as an actor if I didn't give up all the Hollywood nonsense and dig in and learn what acting was really about. Mm-hmm. And so she convinced me. She and another actor friend of mine, Pepe Schildkraut, convinced me to go to Sandy and study.
Yeah.
And Sandy had, he had a lot of fun with me. You know, I was the young Hollywood teen idol who was trying to show that he was serious. And he castigated me and continued to make me feel like there was no place in myself, for myself in the acting world. And he did that on purpose, because what he wanted to do is he wanted you to get down to basics, to get rid of all the nonsense, to get rid of all the posing, and act, really act.
Right.
And it took me, I would say, almost a year before Sandy ever said anything nice about me. But at the end of 2 years, when I graduated from the Neighborhood Playhouse, he asked me if I would teach his method in Los Angeles. And so I became an acting teacher for a while, and that, of course, was the greatest compliment he could have given me, to ask me to teach his method to others.
Had you considered a career in acting early in your life? I know one of the great juicy anecdotes in this book, it seems like the first person that really opened your eyes to the possibility of acting in motion pictures was Groucho Marx, of all people. Had you considered a career in acting prior to that?
No, not really. But when he came up to me and he said, you know, you could be an actor, you have the face for it. So I thought, listen, I was 16 years old, I needed money. I figured being a movie star would make me a lot of money, so why not? And so he introduced me to his brother, who was an agent, Gummo. And Gummo said, well, you should go study. And I didn't really have the time nor the desire to study something. I just thought it should be handed to me on a silver platter, so to speak. And then I finally did. I tried out for something at the Pasadena Playhouse, and I failed miserably, and so I just gave it up until later in my college career.
Mm.
Which, and since you've read the book, you know what I'm about to say, but I understand that others might not, so I'll continue to talk about it.
Please.
I had been a straight-A student. I prided myself in my scholastic abilities, and it was really more competitive than my caring to learn. I just wanted to be better than everybody else.
Right.
So when I was in college, somebody said, you know, why don't you try and take an acting class? And so that suddenly stirred memories of Groucho Marx and becoming a movie star. So I took an acting class, and I was awful. I got the first C I had ever gotten in my entire high school and college career. And years and years afterwards, I continued to have nightmares about the fact that I had gotten that C. And so I think what really motivated me to get into acting was to prove to my teacher and the other students that I was really an A student in whatever I did.
Yeah.
I can't say this was the whole reason for it, but I mean, this was certainly gave me an impetus to do much better in the only thing that I had failed at in my scholastic career up to that point.
Right. And it's fascinating to me. I read an incident that you had on stage where something that occurred on stage made you laugh, and it was completely not conducive to the moment you're trying to create, but you turned that laughter into tears. And it kind of illuminated for me, making parallels between acting and your very successful sales career and producing career, some of these parallels between those two disciplines. And because as an actor, you study, and then you kind of let go of that so you can exist in the moment. And then I read about some of your deals that you've made, and you study, and you come to the table, and you can exist in the moment depending upon the attitude and the approach of the person you're negotiating with. And I'm wondering how you see acting in terms of how it helps you in your career later on.
Well, it certainly helped me in my career as a seller of motion pictures.
Mm-hmm.
Most salesmen who I knew at the time, when I talk about film salesmen, it means that somebody who is trying to license rights to a film to potential distributors.
Right.
And I saw some of my peers, and they didn't really know how to pitch a project. What they would do is they would simply give a very quick, boring synopsis of it and then say, okay, I want $100,000. What do you offer for me? And because I had been an actor, what I would do is I would act out scenes for the buyer, and they would then be able to see in their minds what this might look like up on screen. And if I could move them, or if I could involve them in the project, or the motion picture script that I was trying to peddle them, then they became an easy sale. And so my acting helped that out, because I simply acted all the roles as I was recounting some scenes from any of the projects. I remember one in particular was a picture called Misunderstood, which Jerry Schatzberg directed with Gene Hackman starring.
Yes, sir.
I remember that. Okay.
Yeah.
It was originally from an Italian film called Incompreso, which was one of the biggest tearjerkers of all time. And there's a certain point where the son says to his father, just before he dies, "All I wanted you to say to me was you love me." I can hardly get it out now. I mean, it was such an emotional moment. And so as I would pitch the project to buyers, I would start to cry.
Yeah.
I couldn't help myself. And I remember sitting with some Japanese buyers, and when we got to that moment where I had to say, you know, "All I wanted you to say was you love me," I just started to bawl. And the Japanese buyers came up, and they tapped me on the shoulder, and they say, "Mark, you don't have to cry about it. We'll buy the film at your price."
Yeah. And that account is actually in the book as well.
I think so.
Well, you really did read that book.
Oh, I read every word. I clung to every word of this book. But you have to – that brings up a good point. To be a successful producer and a sales, international sales figure, you really have to believe in and be passionate about these films, don't you?
I can't sell a film if I'm not passionate about it.
Yeah.
Every script I pick up that I want to make, I become passionate, and that becomes the most important film of my life. People always say, "Well, what were your favorite films?" My favorite film is the film I'm doing today.
Yeah.
Basically. And, you know, you talk about producers. Sometimes people just attach themselves to a script and they contractually get the producer credit. But a true producer has to have so many talents. And you asked about what acting had done for me in my subsequent career. Well, it allowed me to understand how to talk to actors, because I was an actor, how to talk to directors, how to deal with script writers, how to attract the right cast and the right director, and then following the process not just through the development of the script, but all the way through the motion picture production, and then sitting as an editor and cutting the picture together and knowing enough about music so that you, because I think really that in motion pictures, music is 80% of the success of a film. Mm. And if you don't quite get that right, and then I'll tell you a story in a second, you may lose the entire film. So a producer has to be a man of so many talents to really be successful. And then he also has to understand marketing, because once your picture is finished, if it isn't marketed properly, and you can't always depend upon other people, if you don't guide them in the way the picture should be fashioned for the audience or the demographic that you're going after. So it is really a difficult profession. There are very few producers who really are accomplished. I wanted to go back for just one second, because it's one of my favorite stories when I talk about the importance of music in a film. We had made a film some years ago called The Neverending Story, which I think today has become quite a classic.
Absolutely.
And when I saw the final cut of the movie with music from a German composer, and I was in Munich at the time with Wolfgang Petersen, who directed it, I said, "We're going to have to replace the music." And Wolfgang became furious with me, because this composer, whose name was Klaus Doldinger, had done a magnificent score for Wolfgang's previous picture, which was a famous film about German sailors and submarine personnel, Das Boot. And the music,
yeah,
as I say, was great, but the music on this particular film, which is kind of a fairy tale, did not work. And so, to prove my point, I hired a composer, who lived in America, Giorgio Moroder, and he did a completely different, lighter, more fun score. We had tested the picture with the original composer's score, the German composer, to audiences who basically only 1 out of 5 liked the movie. And when we put in a different score and exactly the same picture, we didn't change the frame of the picture, but a new score, and 85% of the people loved the movie. So that was one of my best examples of just how important a musical score is for a film.
And this really illustrates how hands-on you are as a producer, whether it's the English dubbing of Das Boot or the music of The Neverending Story. In the book you say, if a producer doesn't tend to every detail and make sure the picture is the best it can be, he doesn't deserve to call himself a producer. Mm-hmm. And two things interest me about this. One is, I think good producers are a unique breed in that they have their creative side, and then they understand the global kind of financial implications of the creative decisions they make. I'm wondering if those two ever butt heads. And I'm also wondering about the relationship with the director, and I'm sure that a lot of them found this very intrusive, this involvement.
To say the least. But what are the two factors that you said might butt heads? The commercial and the artistic? Is that what you're
saying? Creative side and the financial side, yes, sir. Because I'm thinking that what works for a film creatively, does that ever run counter to its marketability throughout the world?
It should not.
Yeah.
Meaning this, when you say creatively, it depends who has the correct creative vision. If one chooses a script and has a particular vision of it, that vision carries through to what you hope is going to be the commercial success of the picture. If you then have your actors or your director who argue your vision, and if their take is wrong, at least in your mind, because you as the producer are the creative guide to the entire process, then the picture can go off track. And that's happened to me a number of times. But no, the correct creative vision, whatever that is, the one that most appeals to the public, and the commercial success of the film should be absolutely unified.
Mm-hmm.
What a producer has to do is this. He has to listen carefully to everybody who talks to him. He has to know what he wants, but he has to be able to change or to modify if something makes more sense to him. But he's the guide. He's the one that the director and the editors and everyone else has to listen to. And I remember in the picture Monster that we did, which was maybe the most critically acclaimed of all the films I've made,
mm-hmm.
One thing I continue to remind my director and the editor was the importance of making certain that we walked a very, very fine line. I said, if we try to make the audience sympathize with our lead character, who was a serial killer, I said they're going to reject it.
Yeah.
We must make certain that we allow them to empathize, to feel what she's going through, but not to espouse it, not to say it's okay. And that was a very, very fine line that we continued to remind ourselves again and again and again. And if we'd gone off by 5% either way, the picture would not have been a success. So
right.
That's the importance of a producer, is to make certain that everybody remembers what you started out to do and make certain that the end product is close to that.
Yeah. Linda, when you're listening to all of Mark's amazing stories, from the anecdotes like introducing Clint Eastwood to Sergio Leone and his involvement with the Cotton Club and his revolutionary company PSO, it has to be quite a daunting task to write this book. And I'm wondering, what frightened you most about this project?
Me.
You know, everything frightened me most about this project. To start off, I had never written a biography, so that was plenty scary.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, how do you write a book about a man who's lived so many lives? And how do you do justice to them all? So that required an extraordinary amount of research on my part. And basically, every time I started a new chapter, I was afraid that I didn't know how to do it. And the most important thing that I was afraid of was that I thought I'd never finish it. And I literally thought on my tombstone they would say...
Wait, you're telling me all this now?
So
that's pretty frightening. I put myself in your hands and you weren't sure?
There was nothing about it that was not daunting. However, everything about it was so interesting. And as you can hear, as I listen to Mark now, I'm thinking, gosh, I wish I'd had that particular quote down. You know, when you get... It's like hitting gold, you know. If you're mining and you hit gold with a vein that's this deep, you sort of can do no wrong. And after a while, I realized that. So, it was daunting and it was thrilling and it still is.
Yeah. Mr. Damon, I want to ask you about one film in particular.
Don't call me Mr. Damon. Call me Sir Angel or Your Highness.
Sir Damon.
Emperor.
Sir Damon. Emperor,
this,
that's better.
Right. This is a film that I've always loved, and as I've matured, the meaning of the film has matured for me. And I know you have mixed feelings about it, and that's 9.5 weeks. And reading this chapter on the production of this film was of particular interest to me, and I'm wondering if you can give our audience just a little taste of how problematic that shoot was and what your thoughts on that film are today.
Well, I don't have mixed feelings about the end product. The only one I had, I thought maybe we could have made a film that was slightly more erotic, but then maybe it would not have carried the same impact if we had gone a little overboard on the eroticism. I think, you know, people today say the film is highly erotic and set the sexual standards for the world in the 80s and so. So, you know, who am I to argue with what feels like a great success? I don't think any director or producer is ever 100% happy with a film. But, and you're right, it's the test of time. People who see that film today do not feel it's dated, which I think is great. The problem is, though, is guiding everyone to the finish line.
Right.
And we had a particularly difficult problem because we had two actors who absolutely hated each other. And yet they come off on screen as the most romantic love story ever told. Mickey was absolutely frightening in how he handled Kim Basinger. I'm talking about Mickey Rourke.
Yes.
And she was so frightened of him and eventually of the role she was playing that I often would have to go into her trailer in the morning and sit with her for a couple of hours while she was coiled the fetal position saying, I can't, please don't make me, I can't come out, I can't act, I can't do it. And finally I would coddle her and tell her how great she was, and she really was great in the movie, and then try both of us to face Mickey and also a director, Adrian Lyne, who was kind of supporting Mickey in the way he was handling Kim, because he thought that they were really getting to her and getting the kind of performance that was needed. But there are ways to do it, and I thought that if I ever got through this film, I would like to kill Mickey Rourke afterwards, and I've had that feeling for the last 30 years, I think. he was very difficult and impossible, to say the least, to work with. But at any rate, doesn't matter what happens behind the scenes, and those are always fun things to talk about afterwards. All that matters is what's on the screen. We in that movie, and I don't recall whether I wrote this or not, but Mickey Rourke had a totally odd idea of what his character should be. And when we first put the picture together and saw the 4 hour and 40 minute cut, Mickey came off so badly. He was a sicko. He was absolutely unappealing. And when we first screened the picture for audiences, they hated it. They would throw things at it. You know, in motion picture research screenings, in order to know that you have a successful picture, you should have 80% or more of the audience who say the picture is excellent or very good. But we had maybe 7% of the audience who said it was excellent or very good, and about 80% who said they absolutely hated it. And that was because of Mickey's performance. Mickey saw his role in a certain way and was intent on coming across that way as this psychopath, which worked totally against the movie, because you want to love him because he loves her. And so we reconstructed his performance frame by frame. We would take moments, for example, after Adrian Lyne would say cut and Mickey would giggle, we would grab that and put a little giggle somewhere. Mm-hmm. Where he would smile because he thought the camera wasn't on him, we would pick that up. We restructured his performance totally. And when he saw the movie, I'm sure he didn't recognize himself at all in it because he was lovable. Mm. And Mickey Rourke is not. But my point is that a movie is made not just in the shooting of it, but in the structuring it afterwards.
Yeah.
And then with the music and everything else and so. But it's a film that I look at today and I love. Recording as I watch it all the agonies that I went through at the time, but saying it was worth it. And, you know, an example of how people never, ever know whether a picture is going to be successful. When that picture was finished, I had our French distributor come up to me and say, "It's awful. I don't know what I'm going to do with it." And I said to him, Philippe, his name was Philippe Hellman, I said, "How can you say that? You haven't shown it to audiences yet. They will hate it." I said, "Philippe, you have to try." He says, "I will try, but they will hate it." And so he released 9.5 weeks in Paris. And 4.5 years later, that film was still playing in cinemas in Paris, the longest playing film in the history of French cinema, of France, in essence. So what I'm saying is you never know. You can never really be sure until that film is put on screens and audiences are loving it or hating it.
Yeah. It's an astounding movie for me. We're just scratching the surface of your contribution to cinema, but I just have a couple of quick questions to close off with.
Mm-hmm.
You guys have been so generous with your time. I wanted to know your take on the new media and the future of the motion picture experience. We've talked to many filmmakers from Paul Schrader on about this subject. Where do you think that's going?
Well, when you say new media, exactly what do you mean?
Well, we're talking about the internet and even short films for cell phones and the experience of actually going to the movies kind of dying out with the exception of event pictures seems to be the common consensus amongst many people.
Well, I think there's no question that's the way it's going. I question how successful it might be for someone to view a movie in 3-minute segments on their cell phone and whether or not the experience could ever possibly be as enveloping as a motion picture experience should be. But on the other hand, if that's how they take it, if that's how they want to see it, and if they continue to contribute revenues to a film, I'm not sure that's the way it should go, but that seems the way it will be going. So the fact is today, nobody really knows. It seems to be going in that direction, but no one knows if motion pictures will ever be as successful as they should be watching it in that way. But one thing that I do know for sure, no matter what the medium is that a film is eventually released in or exploited through, content is always king.
Mm-hmm.
And good movies, no matter how they are exhibited, will be good movies, and if they're bad movies, they will be bad movies no matter if you look at it in 3-minute segments in mobisodes or on your cell phone or whatever.
It's all about the need for storytelling in whatever medium, I think. Linda, looking at this book, and what do you want readers to come away with? What's the essence of this man and this life that you want readers to come away with?
Huh. I think that what inspires me most about Mark is his willingness to keep trying new things, looking at the world in new ways, never giving up. And I think that's very inspiring at a time when people are looking at multiple careers and so on. I think Mark is the. I think you put your finger on it so well, talking about the incident when he was young and, you know, turning his laughter on stage into tears. Mm-hmm. I think that Mark is always willing to be in the moment and to shift accordingly. And I think that that's a great lesson for people. So I would have to say that's what I would like people to take away.
I would like to add something objectively, if I
sure.
can. And I'm not sure which version of the book you saw, Jamie. But we had a later version where I put a little quote in front which hit me one day in the shower. And that was, if you don't succeed in the field of your dreams, you may yet succeed in the field you've never dreamed of. And that, for me, is one of the reasons that I agreed to put the book down, because so many actors came to me and said, you know, it looks like I'm not going to be successful. It's not going to really work for me, this career. And to see that you changed careers, having been a devoted actor for 20 years of your life, started a whole new career, and succeeded in it in a way that no one else had, gave them confidence, or gave them hopes, if you will, that maybe not succeeding as an actor didn't mean the end of their lives, but they could find
right.
something else just as fulfilling, or maybe even more fulfilling. And I think, again, trying to distance myself from my life, which is impossible, but trying to do so and looking at what others told me was the reason for writing this book. And so
yeah.
I'm hopeful that it could prove inspirational for so many people who can see that you can still control your destiny if you're only open to change.
Yeah. And you fought for and you've lived your passion and your dreams, and you continue to do that today. I know that you're producing the upcoming Peter Himes film and
mm-hmm.
Bruce Willis's directorial debut. You still got your hand in the fire. You're still, that passion hasn't waned for the business, has it?
No, it hasn't.
Yeah.
Thank
and
God.
Linda, you have I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I just said, thank God it hasn't, because once my passion wanes, I wane. And I don't want to wane.
Linda, tell me a little bit about this upcoming project for you, your stage musical. It's based on your life or your childhood? Or?
No, it's actually based on my mother's life, and it's
okay.
called The Goldsmith's Daughter. And it's actually the story of my family. My mother was a goldsmith in Vienna at the turn of the century, following in her father's footsteps. And it's a saga. It's one I've worked on for a long time. My career as a composer sort of waned as my career as a writer began, and now I'd like to put them back together. So it's in process.
Well, we wish you the best of luck with that.
I want to add just one thing, Jamie, before we're off.
Yes, sir.
Talking about waning. one of the real reasons for my success has been a devoted wife who has been with me for 35 years. And if it were not for her support and her encouragement and her love, I never could have accomplished what I did. It's my wife, Maggie, who I discovered as a young actress and made her become something much more.
Yeah.
A mother, a wife, my woman. And I think it's so important for so many people's success to have a mate like I have. And I just wanted to pay tribute to her.
And that is absolutely one of the most moving portraits in this book. It is such a beautiful, lasting relationship that you have, and I understand from reading the book that has to mean the world to you. And I thank you both for joining us tonight, Linda and Emperor Damon.
Very good.
Right way to go, yeah.
Yes, yes. You both are welcome back on the show anytime you'd like in the future. It's been an honor.
You've been great. Thank you.
We need you back.
You.
There's so much more to talk about.
That's true.
thank
you
very
both.
Much.
Yeah, thank you.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
That is Mark Damon and Linda Schreier. The new book is called The Cowboy, the Mogul, and the Monster, The Never-Ending Story of Mark Damon. Get it. This is a great... My jaw was open throughout the whole experience of reading this book. It's a wonderful experience to read. Okay, so our lineup of guests, I think our next guest is on the line. I hope this is our... Well, we have two lines open here, so we're going to try this out.
It's Russian roulette.
Our next guest was slated for 6:40 Eastern, and our final two guests are slated for the top of the hour at 7 p.m. Eastern. So if you're not this next guest, please hang up the line, because I don't know the phone number they're calling from.
Yeah, really.
This is a very professional show here.
Throw us a bone.
Yeah. But this is great. This is great. This is another book I read over the weekend. It's a very funny book.
It's hilarious.
Great, quick, fun, fast read. And I'm excited to be able to talk about it. Peter Gelderblom, and I'm sure I'm massacring that last name, Pete Gelderblom, directs, edits, and develops commercials, TV programs, and broadcast design in Amsterdam. And he draws the webcomic Directorama for The House Next Door. And Directorama is a very, very amusing and at times stinging commentary on the latest Hollywood trends and a real tribute to the great directors of the past. And it's just been published in book form. And we're here to talk about it with him. Please welcome to the show Mr. Pete Gelderblom. Pete, are you with us?
Hello.
Hey, how are you, man?
Yeah, I'm fine. Yeah, you said it about right. It's actually Pete Gelderblom. If it starts sounding like a throat disease, you're close.
I was way off. What are you saying? I almost pronounced it right. I was way off.
I don't even want to get in the middle of this, you know?
That is impossible.
This is a great work here, my friend. And thank you so much for coming on the show to discuss it with us. But tell me,
I'm glad to hear you like it. Of course, this being Movie Geeks United, you're pretty much my ideal audience.
Well, you got it right. You hit the jackpot.
We're here for you, buddy. Tell me about as a kid. I know that you were kind of a rabid creative person. And what it was about movies that kind of sparked your interest, and what were those movies that originally drew you to the art form?
Oh, wow. Well, my father used to have a Super 8 camera, and I played around with that when we were going on vacation, and at a certain moment I started making my own little movies. I think it was mostly in the summer of 1984 that I really realized how much I was into this cinematic experience. I think I saw Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. I read a lot about it first, and then I saw it, and that is, of course, and a lot of people don't think it's as good as the first one, but it was the first Indiana Jones that I saw. And
better than the last
really,
one.
It is, yeah. But it's just such a machine when it comes to, cinematic experience. You know, it really grabs you by the throat, and it doesn't let go. And I really dug that. And I think what I really love about film is the way that, especially now that I'm able to make them, even though it are not feature films, but is that you can build perfect moments. You can use just about everything. You can use visuals, but also music and sound. And, you know, normally things will pass you by quite quickly, and you don't know. When you're inside the moment, you don't know how to cherish the moment. But if you with a film, you can really build that moment, and you can get this whole tension arc going, and that's what I really love about it.
Yeah, you and I are in complete agreement about Temple of Doom. And, I've talked about this many times on the show. I think it's the crowning jewel of that series of films, and we're in the minority, man.
yeah, I know.
When did this minority start? Because I've always liked it. I mean, when did this minority...
Well, even Spielberg himself says it. It's his least favorite of the movies. I mean,
somebody should kick his ass about this, because I think the string of films that he made after Temple of Doom... it really shows that he lost some daring, you know.
Yeah.
Like Temple of Doom is really like, you can say anything about it what you want, but it's really a very daring film, and it really, you know, it punches you in the face.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a passionate project. And I think he was also, because of this whole PG-13 thing, I think he was he scared himself with what he had done, with the effect that it had on people. And and fortunately, you know, there was a time that I had given him up, but I really love what he's doing now. So
yeah, mm-hmm. But there's such a combination of. And you're the perfect person to discuss the work of great directors with, and that's the basis of your comics as well. There's such a quality of childhood wonder in his early films, and this was really a turning point for him in Temple of Doom, in that it has all of that, but it's also the first movie where he really delves into some dark territory as well. And I find that it's nonstop. But you're not exhausted at the end of it. You're elated. The movie elates you. It's alive in a way that few movies are. Speaking of great directors, was it the passing of Bergman and Antonioni that really made you start on this Directorama project?
Well, I've been writing about film for quite some time on the internet. I had a website called 24 Lives a Second, and I wrote essays for it, and I was the founding editor of it. And I found that as time went along, my pieces became shorter and shorter, and they became wildly creative. And at a certain moment, I found myself drawing cartoons. And I really liked that medium to not so much say things about film, but to throw up questions really. And I remember that I was drawing a cartoon about Bergman. I read that he had his 89th birthday, and it was just something very funny about. Bergman, and imagine Bergman having a birthday party, you know, that. And I I drew a very gray, dull cartoon of him sitting at a table with a very colorful birthday pie. And he says, on top of the cartoon, it says something like, Ingmar Bergman's 89th birthday turned out to be an appropriately dour affair. And he says, okay, who has the knife? And beside him is the Grim Reaper with a, you know, a big-ass scythe next to him. And much to my surprise, a week later came the news that he was dead. And was like, oh, my God. And I really gasped. And the same day, Antonioni also passed away. And I just started thinking. I had already drawn a cartoon of Hitchcock and Kubrick in Movie Heaven during the Oscars. And I was just thinking, like, okay, what would it be like if a comic strip would start with Bergman entering heaven and meeting Antonioni there, and then a whole, there would be guests at a cocktail party that they're having because they welcome those two to movie director heaven, and that really became the impetus for the whole project.
Yeah, it really, it's kind of reminiscent of that popular artist work. I don't know what it's called, but it's at a diner, and all the Hollywood legends, the Bogarts and the Marilyn Monroe's, are sitting at the diner together. This is the kind of the film geek director's version of that in heaven. But first of all, I want to touch upon some of these other works in this book first. They seem to, they're all very funny, but they have an undercurrent of kind of stinging commentary about some of these new Hollywood trends and where movies are going. And I'm wondering what concerns you about the future of films and that you wanted to express in these?
Well, I do love modern films, and I even you know, big blockbusters I can enjoy very, very much. But I do think that the climate for film, especially in Hollywood, is not very healthy. You've got the very big Hollywood projects, of course, the blockbuster stuff on the one side, and then maybe you have some small pictures. But the ones I like the most, which are the projects that have a middle budget, they get more and more into trouble, or you know, they have to. The marketing people are thinking that they should, you know, speak to a certain crowd or something. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering, like, we still have a good few auteurs, but some of them have trouble actually producing movies at this moment. You know, the Coens can still do it, and P.T. Anderson can still do it, and, you know, there are a couple of those. Yeah, you see others having problems with it. But to be honest, it's not that I really wanted to talk about that. It's more, the comic strip is more about, in the cartoons as well, is really about the medium and what you can do with the medium and the different thoughts and viewpoints that there exist. And they can clash in the most wild ways. And I find that very, very amusing. You know, on the one side, you have someone like David Fincher, who has claimed that nothing good ever came from a happy set. Right. And on the other side is Steven Spielberg. You know, it seems to work for him, a happy set. You have insecure people like Woody Allen, who pretty much loathe his own films. And on the other side, there's De Palma. He says, well, you go on until you have what you want. And so basically, he's very glad with everything he does. And he thinks he has complete control, and he's perfectly happy with what he does.
Right.
And I find these differences very amusing and funny to write about.
Yeah, and they are such different approaches, and I think a lot about Woody Allen and some of the in relation to some of the topics that you're talking about here, because Woody Allen, I think he has the career that every director kind of envies.
Yeah, he does.
He's able to write something down. He's able to go out. He has the financing. He gets to shooting within a couple of months, and he's done.
But he doesn't look at his own movies.
No, he doesn't.
He hates looking. Yeah.
Yeah,
and I find that.
Meanwhile, directors like Schrader and De Palma really have to fight tooth and nail for every dollar they get and to get a film greenlit. And one of the great comics that you have here is about Redacted.
Yeah, that was classic.
Yeah, and it's a man trying to comfort his crying girlfriend in the theater as they're watching Redacted, and he's saying to her, "Relax, it's only a movie." It's very funny on the surface, but it's pretty biting underneath it. I mean, there's a real sense of truth to that to that portrait there. Do you see the deaths of Bergman and Antonioni, with the exception of a couple of the other directors that we have that are still doing exceptional work time in and time out? Do you see that as kind of an end of an era in a way?
Yeah, definitely. I think cinema is changing, and the old time greats and the old greats are probably not approving of the way cinema is going. But I'm probably more positive than you think. You know, I can see value in what's happening in the internet and you know, the different modes of cinema. I can see that it's you know, the collective experience is going, you know, a little bit away. You only have that for the great event pictures, and now it becomes a more private thing, you know, with home cinema and stuff. But yeah, I don't know if that's really, really bad per se. I'm not sure. But I do, of course, hate it when people don't see the value of cinematic works, or they make stupid stuff or whatever. And whenever I can make fun of them, I will.
Yeah.
Go for it. It's fair game.
What kind of situations and characters are you focusing on now in your work? You continue to do this work, and I'm sure that this book will be a success, and you'll continue to make more volumes. What are some other areas of interest that you want to explore with this?
Well, actually, I really want to delve into autorism, what it still means today, and I'm actually going to introduce the first original character in a way. This will be a premiere when I say this, but it will be Alan Smithy.
Oh.
And he will really, really piss all the directors in movie heaven off because he doesn't even exist. And, you know, he's the ultimate hack. And that will really throw up some interesting questions.
That will. Oh my.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's some great stuff. Fantasizing for a little bit. Do you think that these directors that passed are congregating up there in heaven?
No, I don't.
I was going to say, you want Christopher Hitchens and Richard Dawkins to call in, don't you, Jamie, and dispute them?
Yeah. Tell us how our audience could look at this book and purchase it.
Well, I've made a brand new Directorama site. It's called directorama.net. And you can see all the comic strips that have been published on the house. You can watch them over there. Well, what's great about the book is that it also has 31 movie obsessed cartoons that are not available anywhere else. But you can buy the book over there, directorama.net.
Okay. That is directorama.net. Jerry, if you can type that in the chat room.
Yeah, sure.
for those listening that are in the chat room there. You're calling, you live in Amsterdam, is that where you're calling from?
Yeah, I work in Amsterdam. I live in the center of Holland, in a small village.
What is the film scene like there?
I think Dutch cinema is going through something of an identity crisis. there's lots of great talent around here, but there's not really a front figure like Lars von Trier is in Denmark, for example. There's not really a movement. There's just a bunch of people doing different kinds of stuff, and it doesn't really get picked up by the movie-going audience. So it's struggling a little bit. But personally, I'm very much in the commercial corner. I make TV programs and commercials and that kind of stuff, promos. So that's not really my problem. But it is my concern, though. Yeah.
Well, the book is called Directorama. It's great fun, and if you're a movie fan, particularly a fan of great film directors, you're going to eat this up page after page. It's just a gem. And Pete, or however I mispronounce your first name,
thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you so much, man. It's been a great pleasure. And come back anytime.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, anytime, sir. Anytime.
Thank you so very much. You have a good one.
I love the show. Definitely.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Thanks.
Thank you. Bye-bye now. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Okay, Pete Gelderblom.
I think you got it right there, dude. It sounds like you got it right.
I don't think so. But
it was close enough. I was impressed with that.
Thank you. It's a great fun book.
It is.
There's this big guy looking at a YouTube computer screen. He's saying, I am big. It's the pictures that got small.
A lot of classics. Such
truth in this humor here. It's great fun. I know that one of our next guests is on the line. This is another great project. In addition to reading the 500-page book yesterday, I watched their film as well, and it's profoundly good. I kind of teared up at the end of it there. It was very inspiring.
Johnny Cash.
Yeah.
It's you know, his life meant something, I think, to a lot of people in our chat room, especially Greg Dow, who I've been talking to. His music and his life, especially the stuff he did with Rick Rubin, I mean, it meant a lot to all of us. So
yeah,
I can see where you would tear up, and I can't wait to see the film.
There's a section where they discuss those collaborations with Rick Rubin, and I think he shows it to his daughter, that video of Hurt,
mm-hmm.
and she's very upset by it. She says it's very disturbing, and Johnny Cash says, why would you say that? And so, well, because it seems like you're saying goodbye. And Johnny Cash said, well, I am saying goodbye. It's such an artist.
Mm-hmm.
And
one
of the most profound pieces of art that he ever produced came at the end of his life with Hurt. It's an amazing piece of work. And this is an amazing film, and I'm so glad to spotlight it on tonight's show. In a country so deeply divided, you know, the political climate of today, there's no doubt that Johnny Cash is one of the great uniters. And realizing this, filmmakers Morgan Neville and Robert Gordon set out to make a documentary that spoke to the qualities that set Johnny Cash apart and why he appeals to everyone from the goth teenager to the 80-year-old grandmother. The resulting film, Johnny Cash's America, premieres on the Biography Channel on October 23rd. And will be released on October 28th in a very special DVD-CD package. That's another thing. The accompanying CD for this package. Many Johnny Cash jewels here. It is a great pleasure to welcome to the show the filmmakers behind Johnny Cash's America, Mr. Morgan Neville and Robert Gordon. Let me bring their lines up here. Gentlemen, are you both with us?
I am.
I'm with you, Robert Gordon.
Yep, and Morgan's here too. So we're both here.
thank you so much, both of you, for joining us tonight. This is a great film. Tell me a little bit about how you guys met. How early was that? When did you guys first meet, Morgan?
Well, I met Robert probably going on 10 years ago at this point.
Weeks.
Yeah, and you know, I was down in Memphis working on a documentary about Sam Phillips, Sun Records, and and we were introduced by a mutual friend, and we hit it off. And it wasn't until Robert was halfway through his excellent biography of Muddy Waters that he called me and said, I think there's a documentary in this thing. And so we partnered up to do a Muddy Waters documentary, Muddy Waters Can't Be Satisfied. And the rest is history.
So there seems to be a real concentration here on music in its place in the culture. So how did the idea for Johnny Cash come about, Robert, and the idea to tackle this as a subject?
There has been a real concentration on music, I think just because we're both fans. You know, we like mm-hmm. to be in the audience hearing great songs. And we went from a Muddy Waters show to a Cowboy Jack Clement show, who was a Sun Records producer and a lifelong friend of Johnny Cash.
Right.
And from there to a Stax Records documentary. And Johnny Cash was the subject of a conversation between us. We were anticipating the presidential season and talking about the divided nation we found ourselves in, which in a way is part of why we deal in music. It's a lens through to other things, and here it was politics, and it was mm-hmm. we were interested in Johnny and the political spectrum and him as a political or politically inspiring artist.
Yeah. And what's fascinating about Johnny Cash is his spread appeal in the fact that no one ever questioned his patriotism, and yet he was unafraid to speak out against the injustices in the world and the governmental policies that he disagreed with. What was that in him that allowed him to come out kind of unscathed and on top by expressing those views?
This is Morgan. I'd say that, you know, that's kind of the central question of the documentary.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And, you know, if we had to boil it down to a single word answer, I think it would be honesty. That's the word that came up more than any other word. And, and beyond honesty, he was just true to his own convictions. You know, he had basic human beliefs. He was a humanist. He believed in helping people that didn't have a voice. Mm-hmm. He believed in social justice. And sometimes his beliefs cut left and sometimes they cut right, but they were consistent in his own mind. And he was criticized by both sides. People would say, oh, you're being, you're doing too many Billy Graham rallies and you're getting too pious. And he would say, you know, that's how I'm helping, people in need. And then when he was in his kind of activist phase and writing Men in Black, people on the right said, you're becoming an activist. What's that about? And he'd said, you know, I'm just doing what Jesus would do. You know, Jesus is an activist. And I thought that was a great answer. And the idea is that he was playing it down the middle because it was how he saw it. And I just think that's such a great lesson to remind ourselves of in this year, that there are basic things we can agree about as Americans, kind of basic ideas of decency and honesty and humanity. And Johnny was one of those guys that stuck up for those things over and over.
Yeah.
And the other – this is – Robert talking now.
Yes.
The other essential element of Johnny Cash, and I think his widespread appeal, was that he didn't hide from his blemishes. You know, he was a guy who took his hard luck life or the difficulties in life, whether they were things beyond his control, like the economics of his youth and the loss of his brother Jack at a young age,
mm-hmm.
Or the things like his drug abuse, his amphetamine addiction over
sure.
the years, on and off. And he wore those as a badge, and it was a badge that carried some elements of shame, but also some elements of pride, of transformation, of saying, how can I be flawed and still be good, you know? And I think it was a way, we're all flawed, and he reminded us of that, and that
he
we can still be
it.
Good.
Yeah.
Yeah. And isn't that the sign of a true artist? I mean, all of their shortcomings, all of their demons, all of their dreams, it's infused in the work that they do. And this is never more true than it is with Johnny Cash. I mean, it's all there. There's such an authenticity and an honesty, like you guys spoke about.
Cash is, you know, Cash had this real interest in educating his mind and in learning history and in studying ancient history and in studying American history. And in a way, you know, you look at some of these records he made, you know, John Garfield's been shot down, the song, you know, it's like, okay, it's probably not going to be in, you know, on anyone's summer favorite listening chart, but but it's going to be, there's going to be something, you know, somebody's going to learn some history about this, and I'm interested in this. And so he devoted as much time and effort to songs like that as he did to, you know, the songs we know. And I think it's a very democratic approach to artistry, and it's also a good way to learn history, you know. It's going to click for someone.
Yeah, and it endures, too. We have a question in the chat room, and this is touched upon in your documentary. The music establishment. I mean, we think Johnny Cash has survived and will continue to endure for many, many years, but throughout the decades, particularly the 80s, the musical establishment that came to be, he was really running counter to that, and he
struggled
a bit.
As soon as you say establishment, I immediately picture the Johnny giving the finger picture.
Yeah.
You know, because Johnny was against Johnny wasn't necessarily against the establishment, but Johnny was always ready to question the establishment. And when it was right, when he felt it was right, he was ready to agree with it. And when it was, I mean, Nixon invites him to the White House, right? And Johnny Cash says, "I'm not a Nixon. I'm not supporting this war anymore." Yet the White House is calling me, and I can't deny my patriotic duty here. The White House calls; I must answer. And then the White House says, "We request that you sing, you know, these three songs, one of which was Welfare Cadillac, not a Johnny Cash song, just a country song, and a song that was absolutely making fun of, you know, the values that Johnny espoused." And so Johnny says, "Well, I will come to the White House, but I won't sing. Let me check out that song." You know, and he looks into it. "No, I won't do it." So he's ready to obey when it's right to obey and to disobey within that, you know, and to stand up for what he thought was right.
Yeah. And getting to what – yeah, I'll just jump in here. That,
please.
Yeah, I mean, getting to what you were talking about the 80s, I mean, for those people that don't know, you know, Johnny Cash was dumped by Columbia Records in 1985, and he essentially kept that label afloat for many years.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was downsized, basically. And when he came back, with Rick Rubin, it was no thanks to the music establishment. It certainly was no thanks to the Nashville establishment. And when he came back, he was alt-country suddenly. You know, Johnny Cash never changed, but he went from being country to alternative country. And I think that suited him just fine.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that's the shame of, you know, corporatized music industry.
Yeah, I agree. I have a couple of questions, offshoots of what you both have just said. Nixon, essentially one of the most uncool presidents of this past century.
Oh, get with it, man.
tell me why they so wanted to have his presence in the White House.
That's a great question.
Yeah.
No.
Did they not read the lyrics? were they that clueless?
Nixon, you know, we learned that when Cash goes to, I think it's his second time to perform for Nixon, and he does "What Is Truth" from the, you know, and it's the first song. Nixon gets brought in. They're already on stage. Nixon gets brought in, sat on the front row, and Johnny sings the song, which he has just finished writing, basically for this occasion, asking, you know, what is truth, and saying, "We're denying the credibility of our youth here, and their values, and we have to ask, what is truth?" And Nixon sitting right there. But I think that what Nixon, you know, because of what Johnny emblematized, he was the big man in black, you know.
Yep.
He was the upright, straight force.
I just want to throw in one anecdote that I heard that did not make the documentary. But right after Nixon quit the presidency in 1974, I guess it was that Christmas, Johnny Cash and Billy Graham were having Christmas together, and they decided that they were feeling sorry for Nixon, and Billy Graham said, you know, "Well, let's call him and, you know, make him feel better." And Johnny said, you know, "I don't want to call him." And he said, "Well, he was the president," and Johnny agreed, and they called up Nixon and cheered him up, which I think is one of the strangest.
Wow, that is
one of the strangest
very
phone
strange.
Calls.
Wow, to be a fly in that room, man, that would have been great. There's also something about him where he could sing about anything. He could go to those darkest places. Mm-hmm. The songs about murder and Delia and all of these songs. And no one else could sing those songs and get away with it. But he understood, even though he only spent, you know, maybe 4 hours in prison. I think there was something in the documentary about that. Waylon Jennings was saying, you know, I actually have the life that everyone thinks that you've gone.
Merle Haggard, yeah. Merle Haggard says, you know, I served hard time, and, you know, people think about you, but it's me. But, you know, that was very interesting when Merle was on Johnny's show, breaking out into the national scene, and Merle had been in prison and seen Johnny perform, and that sort of inspired Merle's career. Johnny tells Merle, when I'm introducing you, let me tell that story about you seeing me from the perspective of a prisoner. And Merle says, you know, we shouldn't talk about me being in prison. That won't be good for my career. And Johnny told him right there, look, you know, you got to wear your mark, and you've got to work with your mark as part of your life. And let's put it out front. Now, if you hide from it, they're going to come and wave it, and you'll be forever in its shadow. You know, but if you become a light that shines on the mark, then people can be transformed by the mark in the way that you've been transformed by the mark.
Yeah, yeah. It's a wonderful movie, and it covers several points about his connection to the land and to his roots, that he never forgot his roots and his stance against social injustices in the world, and how he was always so relevant. And many very diverse subjects speak about Cash in this documentary.
Morgan, tell him about, you know, the first week of shooting. The first week of shooting occurred in Los Angeles, and I thought that kind of encapsulated the breadth of the show.
Yeah, in 3 days I interviewed Snoop Dogg, Ozzy Osbourne, and Kris Kristofferson.
Quite a combo.
Quite a trio. And the funny thing is, each one of them and everybody else in the documentary had a personal connection to Johnny. I mean, you just would never guess it. And you say, really? You know, but Ozzy, for instance, Ozzy Osbourne, you'd never know this, went to rehab with Johnny Cash at the Betty Ford Center in the early 80s. And Johnny was Ozzy's sponsor. And, I mean, that's something you just never know. You know, Snoop Dogg, who seems like, you know, that might be stunt casting or something, but he dedicated his new album to Johnny. And when I was talking to John Carter Cash, Johnny's son, about it, he said, oh, Snoop was here last week out at Johnny's cabin studio because he wanted to see where Johnny spent his time recording. You know, that he had gone way out of his way to really learn about Johnny Cash. And other people, like Al Gore, who's in the documentary, met Johnny when he was 9 years old because his dad was senator, and he grew up with him. He spoke at his funeral. So all these people really have connections to him.
And it really is indicative of what makes Johnny so great, the wide spectrum of people that he appealed to, and they're all represented there in your film. Obviously, the family played a real part in putting this project together too, didn't they? Did you go and pitch this idea to the family, and they were automatically receptive to it?
They were pretty open to it. You know, I have to give kudos to Steve Berkowitz at Sony, who helped. You know, he had been kicking around this recitation called I Am the Nation that they found in Johnny's tape vault after he passed away, which is Johnny kind of talking about being an American and you know, America as a country. And so all of these ideas were kind of floating out there, and they were thinking of doing some kind of a patriotic-themed CD, and then it all kind of morphed into this. But they were great about it. And, you know, we've worked with the Cash Estate on and off, certainly in our Cowboy Jack Clement documentary, and, you know, we feel like, you know, we were familiar with them and they with us, and it was a good match.
I'm going to pause here and throw in a nonprofit commercial for our Cowboy Jack documentary.
Sure.
Jack Clement produced Johnny Cash at Sun with Sam Phillips, and then several times throughout his career. And Jack is he's the jester of country music. And we made a documentary about him called Shakespeare Was a Big George Jones Fan that captures the madcap and antic ways. It's a Monty Python episode. It's a documentary that plays like a Monty Python show.
Right.
With country music.
With country music.
But it's interesting because that's part of Johnny. I mean, you see a lot of it in that documentary, just a touch of it in this documentary, that, you know, Johnny had a deep sense of humor, too. He could be as goofy as anybody. And that's something you never see. I know I was talking to Tara Cash, Johnny's daughter, and after she saw the Cowboy Jack documentary, she said, "That's my dad." You know, whenever I see Johnny Cash on TV, it's Johnny Cash. It's not my dad. Because her dad was a cut-up. You know, he loved practical jokes. He loved to have fun. He loved kids. He even did a kids album, which I should also plug because it's my kids love it.
There's some just invaluable footage in this. I'm thinking of a session between Cash and Dylan in the studio and just hanging out and talking. And Dylan was a figure like that, too, that was unafraid to bring up social issues in his music. The only thing that I, only kind of person in the mainstream that I can think of that's doing that today is possibly Springsteen. Who comes to mind for you? Who's carrying Johnny's torch?
I mean, Springsteen's definitely in that realm, and the one other person is, I've been thinking of Bono, maybe.
And Neil Young, man. Wouldn't Neil Young?
Yeah, perhaps.
I was going to go with Steve Earle. You know,
Definitely Steve Earle, without a doubt.
Yeah, I mean, what's you know, both Springsteen and Neil Young and Steve Earle have are all now more identified with the left, I'd say. And Springsteen, who never used to talk on politics, is now stumping for Obama, which is great.
The Bush White House isn't going to invite them over, that's for sure.
Yeah, but I think if George Bush called Johnny Cash today, if Johnny was around, Johnny would go.
Exactly. The White House beckons, and I think that meant that was paramount to Johnny in a way, you know, that to heed a call like that, his duty.
Yeah.
But also to take that opportunity and express his opinion.
He would definitely speak out against the Iraq War, I think. If he spoke out against Vietnam, I would certainly think he would have spoken out against
I get nervous. This is about the point where I say, look, I'm not talking for Johnny Cash.
No, I wouldn't talk. I'm just saying, because he had passed away before anything really went south.
Yeah.
In the show, Cindy, his daughter, is interviewed, and she talks about a letter he wrote George Sr. about the first Gulf War against it. And George, you know, the president wrote back making his explanation, which is great that, you know, it's great that the president has to explain himself to a guy who was raised in a, you know, Franklin Roosevelt socialist environment in Arkansas during the Depression, post-Depression days. And, you know, came from as a dirt farmer. The president has to explain himself to a dirt farmer. Amen to that. Amen to that.
Yeah, exactly.
There should be a lot more of that, that's for sure. The movie premieres on the Biography Channel on October 23rd, and it will be released October 28th in a special DVD CD package. If you click on the icon there on our homepage, it'll take you to the Amazon.com link. Just briefly, let's touch upon the later part of his career. This resurgence of Johnny Cash, what did that mean to him?
I mean, I think on a personal level, it meant a lot. I mean, people close to Johnny said that it just gave him a whole new lease on life. I mean, those last 15 years of Johnny's life, he had chronic pain, he had chronic jaw pain, he had all kinds of other problems, and he was diagnosed with all kinds of different conditions and nerve conditions. But when his career took off then again, remarkably, with Rick Rubin, it completely gave him a new energy. And everybody around him said he said it was like the energy he had back at Sun Records when he started out. You know, the kids being into the music, and I think it just really couldn't have made him happier.
Yeah. In the movie, it seems to be his family speaks almost like this was a kind of a cathartic, kind of almost therapeutic experience for him. And I think one of his daughters even says that they told Rick Rubin, you know, keep him working every day, because if he doesn't, he's going to die. I mean, that was
actually Johnny who said that to Rick, but I think Johnny and the family felt it too. And I think to understand the catharsis and the you know, the gratitude, because it has to be understood in the context of the dry season that it followed, that, you know, there was that period where Cash was dropped by Columbia. He makes some records for Mercury that are I think Johnny said at one point he thought his last one for Mercury they printed, 500 copies of. So he is feeling so, like Steve Earle says in the show, like a fish out of water. And yeah. And when he meets Rick Rubin, it's at a supper club. Johnny Cash is playing supper clubs. And, Rick offers a way out by saying, just come sit in front of the microphone and sing what comes to your mind. And that's when the catharsis occurs. Johnny sits there and sings for days and weeks, song after song after song. And he said that that there was no talk of an album until the last days of that. Rick began to say, well, this could go on the album. And all of a sudden, this album was being materialized out of this catharsis, and that it was accepted like it was given as just, a soul expressing itself, I think, was, began the great end to Johnny Cash's career, which lasted for four more albums while he was alive, and, one since then and a box set. I mean, there's no end to it, fortunately. Yeah.
Such honesty in all of his work, but particularly the closing stage of his career, those recordings. The film, was there any hesitance to pursue this because of the popular film that came out on his life not too long ago? And what are your thoughts on that film and its portrait of Mr. Cash?
Well, I mean, from the beginning, we said that this is not the Johnny and June story, which Walk
right.
the Line is the Johnny
mm-hmm.
and June story. And we
yeah.
said there's no point in rehashing that. And so as much as we could, we tried to get into the other stories. So the idea is if you know Johnny Cash, you know his music, you've seen the movie, if you see this documentary, there's a lot that you're going to learn still. We're not just telling you the same old stories. So that was important to us from the get-go.
Yeah,
and,
go ahead.
Well, and as for the movie itself, I liked it. I think I liked it more than Robert did. But, for what it is, for a biopic, which isn't my favorite genre, I thought it was really successful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was.
I thought so, too.
To work backwards, while we're on the Walk the Line, my big complaint against it was the great thing about June and Johnny's relationship is that Johnny really looks at the abyss, the chasm that is at the center of this mortal coil opens up to him, and he can't take his eyes off of it. And June helps him live again, and I just felt like the expression of that in Walk the Line was Johnny threw a beer bottle at a Saturday afternoon, practice. Like it didn't get to his darkness. And I thought that was a really missed opportunity. And what was the first part of the question again?
did that affect how we approached our documentary?
Yes. The hardest part about making the show was the biographical pull. And it was hard for us as filmmakers, and it was hard for the people we interviewed to not, we had to do more explaining in this show before we began it with each person who we would talk to and say, look, we want you to be able to take Johnny. Look, Johnny is not necessarily the subject, but he is the pathway to the subject. And that subject can change. And it was hard for me as an interviewer and as a filmmaker to keep the tires from getting into the biographical rut. And we agreed that this would need a biographical structure, backbone to have progress forward, although, we could play fast and loose with the timeline there because it was thematic more than it was biographical. But it was hard to keep people from – it was hard to prompt people to talk about the meaning of Johnny Cash as opposed to the stories of Johnny Cash.
Yeah, yeah. And you guys did an exceptional job. Check it out on the Biography Channel October 23rd and buy it October 28th because it is a phenomenal package.
Johnny Cash is America.
Johnny Cash is America. I congratulate you both on such a wonderful film. And please come back and talk to us anytime in the future when you have another project.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having us on.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys. Bye-bye now.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Okay, that's Morgan Neville and Robert Gordon. Johnny Cash is America. Gotta love that, man.
No, dude, it sounds fascinating. I look forward to watching it. To the Biography Channel.
Yes.
All right, cool. Wonderful.
Yes. All right. It's been a good show. It's been a great show.
It's been an awesome show. It's been a very... I think with each guest, we could have easily gotten another hour out of each of them. That's how... I mean, everyone was fascinating tonight.
Yeah. Yeah. Directorama, it's great fun. It's a great read. Pick that up. Pick up Johnny Cash's America. Pick up The Cowboy, The Mogul, and The Monster. Just
all
stories,
worthwhile.
Stories
all worthwhile.
After story. Ozzy Osbourne, his sponsor was Johnny Cash. That's
See, that doesn't surprise. That makes perfect sense to me. That just makes perfect sense.
If you want to stay on the right path, I mean, Cash could be kind of
Cash is the one. Cash is who you would go with.
We will be back with you possibly Wednesday night, but definitely next Sunday, where we have a special look at the Costa Gavras film Missing. This is a 1981 film.
With a Criterion release, right? This is our...
Criterion is coming out with a special package for this film on the following Tuesday, a week from this Tuesday, and it is a phenomenal package, and I was so inspired to do a show particularly about this film, and we'll be reviewing that DVD, and we'll take a look at the DVDs of Kingdom of the Crystal Skull and The Happening, which we've seen the DVD package of that, and so we got plenty to say about that.
Mm-hmm. There you go. But yeah, you do have a lot to say, no doubt.
Yeah.
Why don't we end on that note?
and this Friday, I'm sure we'll dedicate a segment to next Sunday's show after we're able to see
W. We will all talk about W, I have to say, I'm really...
No, go ahead, man. Go ahead.
I'm just surprised how even-handed it sounds.
It does.
Yeah.
It's going to be an exciting show. So stay tuned to our bulletins and blog postings to find out what's coming on and when it's coming on. Thanks for joining us, everybody. We'll see you next time.
Good night, everyone.